Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky, where a clear voice for science, interviewing the world's top scientists. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, a report on world governments that met to save biodiversity, life-saving vaccines, and meteor showers. First up, a scientist soundbite.
Animals in general can use nature out there to treat their diseases and get rid of parasites.
That was Emory University scientist Jaap de Rode. Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl has more on Dr. de Rode's research.
Thanks, Jorge. So humans aren't the only creatures who use medicine. Butterflies do too. Monarch butterflies flock to a plant called milkweed when they're sick. Now they feed on milkweed normally. But in the fall of 2010, Dr. de Rode discovered that monarchs are drawn to a special variety of milkweed when they fall ill. He explained it.
Monarchs are often infected with a parasite, Ophryocystis electroscira. That's a very long name. What it does, it actually makes the monarchs quite sick. Those monarch butterflies won't live as long, they don't fly as well, they don't mate as well.
In a lab experiment, Dr. de Rode found that when female monarch butterflies are infected with this parasite, they show a strong preference for laying eggs on a type of milkweed known as tropical milkweed. The chemicals in this particular milkweed weaken the parasite, hence their medicinal value.
And so what is really interesting about it, I think, is that when the adult butterfly is infected with the parasite, it cannot do anything about it anymore. And the butterfly cannot get rid of it at that point. It also cannot prevent the transmission of those parasites from its own body to the eggs that it's laying on milkweed. So it cannot prevent the future infection of her offspring. But apparently what these butterflies can do is lay those eggs for the caterpillars that are going to become infected on a plant species that will reduce the parasite growth and thereby reduce the disease symptoms in those offspring.
It's actually a very motherly kind of act, right? It's not so much for the mother, but for the children.
That's exactly right. So the mother doesn't cure herself. She really excels in this maternal care where she provides her offspring with the medication that they need.
How did the butterflies know to use this plant as medicine?
We have a hypothesis, and the idea is that monarchs can smell these different plants. Now, the other thing that monarchs do is when they go to a plant, they will land on top of the plant and they will actually taste the plant. And they do this partly with their feet. They have little taste receptors in their feet. They will tap the leaves and thereby determine whether the milkweed is suitable to lay an egg on. So we think it's a combination of smell and taste that lets the monarch know this is a good plant to lay eggs on. This may have medicinal properties.
And there's another neat thing to think about. If insects use plant medicine, how many other animals do too? And where do humans fit into the picture? Researchers don't really know the answer to that yet.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl.
Wait, see, there'll be no force in soil. Your hopes cannot create the growth. Watch with your heart. Let go that toil. Palm grip, let's slack the reins. Lay off those words, those frames. Sometimes your thoughts outweigh the hand.
That was a song by a band from Austin, Texas called The Monarchs. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. You'll find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. So monarch butterflies can heal themselves, but an October 2010 study revealed that one-fifth of mammals, birds, and amphibians are currently under threat of extinction. Lindsay Patterson has a report on an international meeting called the Convention on Biological Diversity. Lindsay, what's happening?
Well, Jorge, delegates from nearly 200 countries met for the past 2 weeks in Nagoya, Japan, to work out a set of 20 targets for 2020 that aim to slow the rate of plant and animal extinctions around the world. It's hoped that this meeting in Nagoya will make significant progress towards the very difficult goal of reducing biodiversity loss. I talked to Charles Perrings. He's an environmental economist who recently published a paper that made recommendations on how to improve these targets. He said that world governments haven't had a great track record on meeting targets so far.
The Convention on Biological Diversity had set this target to be achieved by 2010 of reducing the rate of biodiversity loss. And with one or two exceptions, almost every country in the world has failed to meet that target. So the rate of species decline is increasing, not reducing.
Dr. Pering said that in contrast to the vague 2010 target, it's important that 2020's targets are actually achievable and that governments will be able to measure their progress toward success. Dr. Pering summed up the situation.
It's a problem that has an international dimension and it requires coordination between nation states. And that, frankly, is still very, very hard. But it's what the Convention on Biological Diversity was set up to do.
And we'll be following this story in the coming weeks. Thanks, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
Lindsay Patterson. This is Earth Sky, and we're heard 15 million times daily around the world on 1,800 radio stations, including Voice of America. Taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Today on Weird Science, Ryan Britton has two interesting stories on the possibility of planet Earth having some alien neighbors and how we're going to handle a close encounter.
Right. A study just released by the University of California, Berkeley, predicts that solar systems like ours, those are solar systems that have rocky Earth-like planets, could be remarkably common in the universe. In fact, nearly one in four stars, like the Sun, could have at least one Earth-sized planet. This comes from astronomers Andrew Howard and Jeffrey Marcy, who studied 166 stars similar to our Sun. Looking at the evidence collected, the team predicts that about 23 out of every 100 solar systems have evidence of Earth-sized planets. These study results are available in the journal Science.
So there could be billions and billions of planets out there with life on them.
Right. And there are people already thinking about how we should interact with intelligent life from other planets. Should we visit them, or potentially more probable, if they come and visit us? We see this in science fiction quite a bit. In movies about visits from aliens from other planets, a human gets nervous and accidentally shoots an alien, or humans decide to do awful experiments on an intelligent life form in the quote-unquote name of science.
Yeah, in the movies, we tend to shoot the aliens first and then ask questions later.
Right, right. And so Kyle Munkittrick, who is a program director at the Institute of Ethics and Emerging Technologies at New York University, has already made the assumption that there are billions of planets, like you said, all over the universe, just teeming with life. And he thinks that should a civilization come for a visit, we need to be better prepared. So on the blogs of Discover Magazine, he has written the first paragraphs of what he calls the Alien Bill of Rights. So the preamble of this Alien Bill of Rights states, "The people of Earth recognize that any extraterrestrial that is self-aware shall be protected by a series of rights." And among these rights include Article 2 that states, "We shall make no active aggression against an intelligent life form from another planet, if we have no evidence that they are attacking us." Article 3 states that we shall not unjustly imprison aliens. Again, Munkittrick wants to make sure that should any aliens come and visit us, or that we humans come into contact with, that we treat them ethically, and with respect.
Yeah, I wonder if the aliens have a Bill of Rights to protect us.
You would hope so. The thoughts here are pretty far out. But given the recent study by the University of California I just mentioned, they may not be as far out as we first thought. We might need to be better prepared in the case that we make contact.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton. We'll be back after this. Earthsky, a clear voice for science. And now a story on vaccines. Vaccines are substances that stimulate the body's immune system to protect them against infection or disease. The World Health Organization estimates that vaccines have saved the lives of 2 to 3 million people each year. I spoke with Dr. Claire Broom, MD, who chaired a committee for the National Academy of Sciences in the United States that looked at ways to improve that nation's vaccine plan, which other nations look to as a model. Dr. Broom, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, what is the state of vaccines in the United States today, and how does that compare to the rest of the world? Maybe you can give us a bit of an overview here.
Certainly. The news is generally good. Approximately 90% of children have received the routine childhood vaccines, which is a very good level of coverage. And I think what's most exciting is that it has been possible to develop and distribute new vaccines over the last 20 years. So the system really has been able to use modern science to develop vaccines against childhood killers. Compared to the rest of the world, our coverage is higher. The real challenge is getting these new vaccines to children, for example, in developing countries who may not have the resources to have the benefit of these vaccines.
Would you please maybe give us a for instance, what are some of these countries you're talking about and what are some of these diseases you're talking about?
Well, maybe the best example is a disease called pneumococcal pneumonia. And the new vaccine is called the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. Now, pneumococcal pneumonia is the leading killer of young children in the developing world, in Africa, India, Southeast Asia. And so actually the world is coming together behind funding from the Gates Foundation and from many countries to try to make this vaccine available in the developing world.
What would you say is the biggest misconception people have about vaccines?
We in public health are in some ways victims of our own success. We have 90% coverage with these very effective vaccines, so the diseases are pretty invisible. However, as we've seen with the whooping cough epidemic in California, the diseases are not gone. And when people choose not to vaccinate their children, the children are still at risk for diseases which can kill the children. And I think this is something that is relatively invisible to many parents. Of course, they want to do what's best for their children, but they're just not aware that these diseases are not gone. They are just controlled by the very high levels of vaccination that we have in this country.
That was Dr. Claire Broom on vaccines. You'll find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Sky, a clear voice for science. Lindsay Patterson joins us now in the studio to talk about something called a frozen zoo. Lindsay, what's a frozen zoo?
Well, a frozen zoo is kind of like a seed bank for animals.
It's a place with samples of tissue, cells, and DNA frozen in liquid nitrogen. It's probably not as fun to visit as a live zoo, but the Frozen Zoo in San Diego, California has samples for nearly 1,000 different species, and some of them are endangered.
Lindsay, what's the point of having a frozen zoo? Why are scientists doing this, and what are they doing with the samples?
Well, the samples are a really valuable resource for scientists who are interested in saving species. That's because they contain a lot of genetic information about animals that might start disappearing from the Earth. And the exciting news now is that geneticists recently figured out how to turn frozen skin cells into stem cells, which could actively help save endangered species. I talked to Dr. Oliver Ryder, who directs the Frozen Zoo, and I asked him to explain what this discovery actually means.
We've been saving these skin cells for over 30 years, never imagining that it would be possible to treat these cells to unleash metabolic activity that would turn them into stem cells. This has been done for mouse cells and human cells, and we reasoned that perhaps this could be done for endangered species and might contribute to their conservation.
Can you tell me a little bit more in detail, how would the stem cells actually help to preserve an endangered or threatened species?
There are two major ways. One would be to support the health of individual animals that were genetically important for a breeding program. Then the animal could breed. The other possible option is that the stem cells could be used for reproduction. That is, they could be used for cloning individuals.
Could this be used to actually, I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but would this be used to actually bring back animals from extinction?
I think bringing back extinct animals, especially ones that have been extinct for a long time, isn't an appropriate use of the current resources that we have in a time of vanishing biodiversity. I think our efforts are better spent in trying to prevent extinctions and explore whether this kind of technology could usefully contribute to that.
So, Lindsay, Dr. Ryder is saying that the idea is that these stem cells can cure and clone endangered species.
Right, and that could eventually make a big difference in whether a species goes extinct or not.
Thanks, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson. And we're Earth Sky, clear voice for science.
This is not a dream. I belong to this place I stand on. And it's light years away. Light years away.
You'll find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Sky watcher Deborah Bird is here now to tell us about the global night sky and November meteor showers. Hi, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. There's a major meteor shower that happens every November, and it's seen from all around the world.
Ooh, a meteor shower. Okay, so it's time to plan a camping trip.
That's right, because you need to have a really clear, dark sky away from city lights to get the best view of any meteor shower. This is the Leonid meteor shower, and the best time to watch is on the very early morning hours of November 17th and 18th. But you might also see a meteor or two from this shower on any night around that time.
So that's the early morning of November 17th and 18th. Now, is there a chance to see what sky watchers call a meteor storm for the Leonids?
Well, this shower, Jorge, has been known to produce some meteor storms in the past, but there's no Leonid meteor storm predicted for 2010. This year, you can expect to see maybe 10 to 15 meteors per hour at the shower's peak. But, you know, people get excited about just seeing one really good meteor or shooting star crossing the night sky.
I know, they're really beautiful. So what else can you tell us?
Jorge, you mentioned meteor storms, and this is one of the most famous meteor showers because it has been known to storm in the past. Leonid meteor storms are thought to happen about every 33 to 34 years. That's when you see not just 10 to 15 meteors per hour, but maybe thousands of meteors per hour, or maybe even hundreds of thousands of meteors per hour.
Wow.
Yeah, the really great one, the really great storm in living memory was the Leonid meteor shower of 1966. Many people alive today saw hundreds of thousands of Leonid 100 meteors all radiating from a single point in the sky.
That's amazing.
I know. And some people who saw that shower said that they wanted to lie down on the ground because they had such an amazing sensation of Earth moving through space.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. That's our show. Thank you for joining us on Earth Sky. This week's show is recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, 100 Flowers, The Monarchs, Sleep Good, Daniel Webb, Dana Falconberry, The Story Of, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.